This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is General Anthony M. Tacuba, who served his country for more than three decades, becoming the second Philippine-American to become a general. Trained as an armored officer, General Tacuba served as acting director of the Army Staff during the Iraq War. Earlier, he had been head of the Army Community and Family Support Center. It was Lieutenant General David D. McKernan, General Tacuba's boss as commander of Coalition Armed Forces, who appointed him on January 31st to conduct what was then described as an informal investigation in detention and determined operations, focusing in particular on the allegations of maltreatment at Abu Ghraib prison. General, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks very much.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Manila, Philippines in October of 1950. Raised there until I was 11, and my family immigrated to Hawaii in July of 1961.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Very much. They're deeply religious people, Catholic, Roman Catholic. And my mother, of course, raised me since my father was out. He was with the U.S. Army at the time, and we were not stationed with them until we all moved to Hawaii at the same time. But their values, their family values, their deep family values, therefore they were origins of a poor family, poor upbringing, and they taught us a lot of discipline. So it was quite a bit of a struggle, you might say, growing up under their tutelage, but it was very valuable in my growing up.
And in reading about you, I got the sense that they really imbued in you, however parents do that, a sense mm-hmm. of integrity, of respect, and honor, values that I would imagine would be important later in your military career.
Absolutely. My father's side, of course, discipline, structure, him being in the Army, of course, as a sergeant. My mother, on the side of her maternal side, gave us a great amount of loving because, like I said, she raised us in his absence. And given all those circumstances, she would often remind us about hardships, what she experienced during World War II and what my father experienced during World War II.
And you're talk a little about that, because for your family, you weren't born yet, but World War II was a very important experience, mm-hmm. which dealt with the Japanese mm-hmm. Invasion on the one hand, but also your father was drawn into the U.S. Army.
He was. He was enlisted. He enlisted in the U.S. Army, actually with the Philippine Scouts, in February of 1942, and fought at Bataan. There was a truck driver at the time. He was principally responsible for hauling not just supplies but casualties, to include those who were killed in action. And he was captured along with a lot of Philippine and U.S. Armed Forces troops in Bataan in 9 April 1942. But he escaped 3 days later from the march, unlike my cousin and my granduncle, who endured a year's worth of prison time as POWs at Cabanatuan. And during that time, he escaped, and suspected, though he would not voice his experience of fighting against the Japanese. And so his experience during that time of horror and hardship resonated with him. My mother, of course, she lived across the street. She lived in Manila at the time of World War II, mm-hmm. and she lived across the street from a POW camp, Japanese POW camp. And she would often go into the camp to help with the wounded, with the Allied prisoners, which included also U.S. nurses, U.S. Military nurses. And oftentimes, when as young kids, she would not... when we would not eat our food, she would convey to us the hardships that she endured, and that the torture, the hunger that she experienced and what she saw during the war. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a revelation for her that, and for her to share with us much more than what my father did.
Mm-hmm. And so, as a result of this experience, when did you decide you would go into the military? Your father's in the military.
Right.
Your family has these wartime experiences. Mm-hmm. Was it later in school, or was it inevitable?
Well, it was, you might say, all of the above. The high school in Hawaii that I attended was one of seven high schools that made it compulsory for male students and also the female, those volunteers. Junior ROTC was compulsory. So it was mandatory from our sophomore to our senior years. So that helped shape my thought about what it's like to be in the military, even at that early stage of my life. Knowing what my father had experienced and that sense of discipline that he had, he was a taskmaster. He was a strict disciplinarian. I decided I was going to enroll in Army ROTC. I applied to West Point, but my academic and scholastic achievements were not competitive enough, so I was not accepted to West Point, nor did I get an ROTC scholarship. But I went ahead and enrolled anyway, 4 years in college, and I received my commission in May of 1972 from Idaho State University.
And what were your interests in school other than military? What did you major in?
Quite a bit of interest. I like history the best, followed by geography, a bit of anthropology, astronomy, that sort of thing. More on the liberal arts side of the house than on the sciences, even though I took, I enjoyed the sciences and geology, for instance, but very bad in math. But I struggled, and obviously I did well.
Students out there who might watch this program are probably, you know, some may be interested in going into the military. Mm-hmm. What are the skills, do you think, that are required to be a good soldier?
Well, let me just preface that by saying that not everybody is cut out to be in the military. And those who wish to join the military will find it very, very difficult initially. But the experience to be trained, to have that sense of discipline, to be structured in your life, to have that sense of duty, sense of obligation to serve your nation is all powerful. The experience that you gain of being a leader, because from the start, a young soldier or young officer are trained to be a leader, and they're given the necessary tools, the mechanics of, and also the teachings to learn how to lead and learn how to follow at the same time. So, and I think that's probably the best thing that they will experience is their ability to lead in the ability to be a leader of the best young men and women that we have in the United States military.
Some men and women sort of rise above others. Is there something that makes an extra difference in people who really emerge to significant leadership roles in the military? I mean, is there some quality of military leadership that sort of stands out in your mind among the officers who you've worked under?
Yes, the military is a very competitive profession. You excel in whatever vocation or skill that you may have in the military, whether you're a truck driver or a tank commander or an infantryman or a logistician. It's highly competitive. And those who rise to the occasion are the ones who show that character. It's kind of indescribable. But they know when they shine because people don't, soldiers typically don't question their desire to follow this young leader. They're very caring. They show compassion towards their troops. Hmm. They're very decisive. They're very deliberate. And of course, they show confidence and competence. All of those things mixed together brings about this character of the MacArthurs of the world, the future MacArthurs, or even an Eisenhower, or even Patton. And you know, and there's those who become role models in front of their soldiers, and not just them, but to their community as well. So soldiering really is an affair that a few would experience with great appreciation, but once you appreciate it, you're greatly satisfied by it.
And it sounds like that the followers, that is the soldiers, emerges out of this is an element of trust, basically,
right.
Of confidence in what they're being told to do and so on.
Right. You're absolutely right. Let me just add on to that. It is the responsibility and obligation of a leader to train, equip, feed, pay their soldiers. And, of course, be sure to look after the welfare of their family members. It's a combination of all of the above. And that commitment is sometimes, and that obligation and that responsibility oftentimes are forgotten or set aside. But once reminded that they're there to lead the soldiers, and that reminded that the soldiers today deserve the best leadership that the Army can provide, nothing will stand in their way.
In your more than three decades in the military, you really must have seen the military changed a lot. And let's talk a little about that, and let's follow up on what you just said. Has the military done as good a job in taking care of its soldiers as its missions have become very different over the course of your career?
I believe so. I mean, it's not as if we're being stagnant or stale or, you might say, being absent in our ability to improve our warfighting capability or increase our readiness. I came in at the tail end of Vietnam. That was in 1972. And as you could recall then, our Army was coming out of Vietnam. It was being hollowed out, you might say. We had problems with volunteerism, and we had problems of retention and the like. Drugs and race relations was rampant. But we hurtled over those consequences. And over time, in the last 30 years, we've transformed ourselves as the best Army in the world, as the best military in the world, bar none. You can see the significance of what had happened in the last three to four years. So the leadership side of that, I think, is incredibly important. Our recruitment is there. Our retention is there. Our educational system is bar none one of the best. And at the end of the day, when that soldier or that officer leaves the active duty and get employed by the civilian sector, they're probably more prominent in seeking employment because they've been trained, they've learned how to lead, they know how to lead, and so they all become a well-rounded citizen and a contributor to our community.
How has the events of 9/11 changed the military's role, if at all?
Not very much. We have the responsibility to defend this nation. And I think that 9/11 brought about the notion that we should have been prepared more. Well, it's not just the military. The military is one element of the national elements of power in this nation, the other three being information, diplomacy, and economy. So just one segment of it. But given what had happened in 9/11, I think we rose to the occasion. I think our nation had this sense of urgency, the sense that we're going to defend this country. The feeling of volunteerism became an element of character for our young men and women to join the military because, you know, we obligate ourselves. Service to the nation was emblazoned then. A lot of our young men and women answered the call of duty. It's just the nature of the character of this nation.
One of the important interfaces of the military is with the rule of law and international law, you know, in the sense—and I want to talk a little about that before we sort of get into the inquiry with regard to Abu Ghraib. And I guess the question is, and in what you've already said, one gets a sense that there has to be rules in the military if this discipline is going to work, on the one hand.
Sure.
And that is something that the leaders have to provide before, during, and after the missions, the new missions that they give.
Correct.
Now, what about international law? Because in a way, much is made of this problem of, well, if we go down certain roads in this fight on the war of terrorism and we sacrifice international accords, then down the road that can be a problem for our soldiers mm-hmm. when they are captured, when they're in different conflict. Talk a little about that.
Now, let me go back to your first statement.
Yeah.
From the very first time a soldier enters training, there are, what it's expounded on them are the military values that we have. Each services have their set of values, but what's common amongst the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, the Marines, so even the Coast Guard, are the elements of selfless duty, the element of honor, the element of integrity. I mean, those are the three common things that resonates amongst the three services. Then they're given training on the international law, most appropriately the Geneva Conventions. That is trained upon them, that is reminded upon them. We also have a set of doctrine, policies, regulations, you name, that guides us and that governs us in terms of our practice of soldiering, being a Marine, being an airman, and being a sailor or being a Coast Guardsman. That is rigid, but we're not perfect. So when somebody strays away from those sets of values and policies and whatever have you, we guide them back to those elements. Because if not, and if we violate those things, we are also governed by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We're separate and distinct from our civilian laws. So those are the rigidity and the deliberateness of how we train our soldiers, our airmen, our Marines, our sailors, and Coast Guardsmen. So we are a reflection of the institution much more than what are much, or I should say, as expected when our founding fathers crafted the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Now, when the Bush administration launched the war on terror, mm-hmm. it creates a kind of a new set of dilemmas, it would seem, or is that correct, in how one approaches the battlefield? Because I think some of these issues are clearer when you're fighting a traditional nation state. Mm-hmm. If you're fighting the Iraq army, a lot of these rules seem easier to enforce. Are there problems raised when the enemy is terrorism, which creates a level of confusion about what the rules require?
You know, that's a question that sometimes gets people to struggle in their thinking. You know, we've been fighting wars in modern times today, whether it was the Spanish-American War, of course, the Civil War, World War I, II, and whatever have you. And each time, we are governed by a set of rules of law. And most of the time, they're governed by international law. And you're going to have torture. You're going to have mistreatment of civilians. You're going to have destructive effects of destroying a country, for example. It's its infrastructure. But rules are made over time. So you might say, is terrorism a new kind of war? Well, perhaps. You know, but things were written to try and ameliorate those things that are sometimes difficult to govern. Well, the French did that in Algeria. You know, they did that in Vietnam. We were also involved in My Lai, if everybody could remember that. T.E. Lawrence was killing a lot of Turks and whatever have you. But there are certain rules of law, laws of warfare, the Geneva Convention, and we have courts, the International Courts of The Hague, for example, that are set upon or established to deal with these things. But you can't rewrite or create a new set of law and say that we have a new kind of warfare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a misguided thinking, if you sign the experts, you know, there is one thing that actually have remained steadfast in the kinds of conflicts that we've fought. And that's our Constitution, for example. The four Geneva Conventions that were written over time, that have set the stage for us to follow the rules. Because if you're going to change the rules so we can fight a new kind of war and lower those kinds of rules to the same level of no rules that our adversary are fighting, you know, it's kind of rather disingenuous, I think, because we should hold ourselves to a higher moral standard and not lower that because there's a new enemy fighting out there. If we do that, we lose the high moral standards by which our country was established, and the higher moral standards that we ask our military to train our soldiers and our military forces. Mm-hmm. What is right for our military forces ought to be right for the civilian authorities, not two sets of standards. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we lead ourselves to ambiguity, and it's ambiguous and it's chaotic enough to fight a war without creating another set of ambiguous set of circumstances or rules of law.
It sounds like, to a non-military person who's thought a little about this, that if you deviate from the line you're describing, that you're doubly cursed, because it must ultimately affect discipline, which the Army needs to run a military, on the one hand. And then it sets you up, in the second case, to be subject to entice other adversaries to do the same thing to our soldiers.
Right. Exactly. For example, there were over 190 signatories to the Geneva Convention. So you find a legal opinion that suits you, suits our country, to fight this thing called extremism. So once that's written, of course, vetting it with other countries would probably take a long period of time. So you create one for the convenience of, for a United States, for example, to fight that war without consulting the other countries and saying, well, what do you think? Well, okay, I don't think that was done properly. Or having that country, another friendly country, that says, okay, that's appropriate. But at the same time, are they willing to risk their forces to subscribe to something that is questionable? Because the other enemy may not have the same kind of rules or will not follow the rules, but then would use that as a stage to say, see, I don't have a rule, but you're violating your own rule. So does it make it right? I don't think so.
Let's now talk about the inquiry that you led. But before we start talking about that, I have the sense, and I think it's important to emphasize this, that your personal story and what you learned from your parents positioned you, together with your understanding of the rules of war and the rules that the Army must live by, to be well positioned to take on this assignment. Mm. So that's an observation. So the question is, well, what was the assignment? How did the inquiry into Abu Ghraib wind up on your desk?
Funny you should mention that. Of course, I had the misfortune of doing that, but at the same time, I think I had the fortune to contribute to correcting the revelations, at least from the military standpoint. Yes, it's true that my family value was born out of that, but more importantly, the training that I received in the military was very valuable in shaping my thoughts. And the great leadership that I learned, the great values, I should say, I learned from the leaders that had entrusted in me the ability to lead soldiers and passed on to me, shared with me the essence of great leadership, led me to think that if it doesn't look right, it won't look right. Mm-hmm. And I was directed to conduct the investigation because I was available. I was there. And they wanted to do this rapidly. So, and then at the same time, I had a team of soldiers that expected me, as their leader, to come to a conclusion that Abu Ghraib was not right. Because if I deviated from that thinking to even have them perceive or think or assume that I was trying to cover up by manipulating or editing or contriving a false report, then we all collectively have violated the sense of trust, the sense of honor, and most importantly, the integrity by which we are supposed to uphold.
I have a quote here that I believe this is from your Senate testimony, where you said, "As I assembled the investigation team, my specific instructions to my teammates were clear. Maintain our objectivity and integrity throughout the course of our mission in what I considered to be a very grave, highly sensitive, and serious situation. To be mindful of our personal values and the moral values of our nation, and to maintain the Army values in all of our dealings, and to be complete, thorough, and fair in the course of the investigation."
I believe that. Mm-hmm.
So the pictures were out there of what had happened. And were you shocked by what you found in the course of the investigation, even more than the pictures had shocked the country?
I was extremely disappointed. I was angry. I was in disbelief, more so than being shocked, because it was unsurprisingly unbelievable that something tragic like that had happened in a prison site that was not to be. And then it opened up a whole series of investigation that if it happened there, gosh, it could have happened elsewhere. And it did. There were cases of investigations in Afghanistan. There were cases of investigation that was being conducted against special operating forces. So, and I didn't show those photographs to members of my investigation team because I wanted to be sure that we remain objective, that we are clear, and that we're not going to speculate. And because I did not want to jade their thoughts in getting to the facts. The statement you read was basically, do not speculate, do not be subjective, because what I'm going to see, they're going to see. What I'm going to read, they're going to also read. What I'm going to experience, they will experience. So it was a very open investigation. I wanted some 23 set of eyes to see it, to ensure that I was not being misled. I'm not misleading myself and the country when this report becomes final.
And we should emphasize that the charge of your investigation was to look at the military police at Abu Ghraib. So it wasn't a broader investigation of the Defense Department or some broader context than that, correct?
Yeah, it was originally that. But Abu Ghraib was a prison complex that did not just contain military police. It also contained detainees. Mm-hmm. It also contained other elements of the military and other elements of other government agencies. So you can't say just inspect these military policemen because they were associated or were being supported or were involved with other elements of U.S. and coalition forces. There were also agents from the Department of officers from the Department of Justice that were helping with the prison standards. Mm-hmm. So to have me go there and say, well, let me do this investigation myopically and, you know, without looking at the peripheral situation that is resident on the prison compound would have been rather questionable mm-hmm. at best.
Now, in the conclusions of your report, I'm going to go into what you were just talking about in a minute. But I just wanted you called a spade, as we say, and the report concluded that between October and December 2003, at the Abu Ghraib confinement facility, numerous incidents of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses were inflicted on several detainees. The systematic and illegal abuse of detainees was intentionally perpetrated by several members of the military guard force. So not showing your team the pictures, they found what had happened anyway, and it was very clear that this really went against what the Army stood for, what America stands for, and so on.
Exactly. Yeah. That was our investigation was preceded by other investigations, and most notably by visits of the International Red Cross. And there were reports of that. They've made several visits, and they documented their visits, and they documented their observations and what they saw. So, you know, the revelations that we exacted on the investigation was a follow-up to all those things. But the investigations, or not the investigations, but the reports done by the International Red Cross or other investigations was a series of disjointed investigatory events, you might say. You know, one would say that, hey, something is going on here. Let's put all things together and say, oh, gosh, there seems to be a trend here. And the trend, of course, was included in our investigation, and a dozen other investigations occurred over that.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about this puzzle that you confronted, which you were talking about a minute ago. And I think as an introduction to our audience, you have here a war on terror, which we've already talked about, where we're rounding up terrorists and alleged terrorists all over the world and shipping them off to Guantanamo. That is part of the war on terror. We have now invaded Iraq, where we have an enemy, presumably the Iraqi army, Saddam Hussein, and so on. And then this facility that you're looking at is used to essentially house people who have been taken by the military. Mm-hmm. Now, immediately there was a larger political problem. I'm trying to understand how this place emerged. And what I sense is that our government was confronted with a puzzle as to who the insurgents were. So we lost sight of who we were fighting. We didn't know. And so part of what we were doing was throwing people into Abu Ghraib to get the intelligence to tell us the nature of the insurgency. Is that a correct reading of the complexity that you were
again? It was very complex. I was talking to several Iraqi people.
And that is detainees or just...
Just regular citizens that said that when Saddam Hussein was in power, they knew who the enemy was. Mm-hmm. But when the United States and coalition forces arrived, they don't know who the enemy is.
Mm-hmm. The Iraqis don't, yeah.
Right, because there are so many elements there. Yeah. And they welcomed us. Three decades of a brutal regime and then somebody else would come in and rescue them was very appreciated by, very grateful by the Iraqi citizens. But then when the forces of Saddam Hussein's military somewhat dissipated, disappeared, you might say, and then they became either Fedayeen at the time, we had labels for them, former regime elements, you got the Ba'athist people. I mean, there are so many names, there were so mm-hmm. many factions, and if you saw the 60-minute interview done by Mr. George Pirro on Saddam Hussein, he said, you know, he couldn't fight a large force, modern force, like the United States military and its coalition friends, so they went to revert into what they call the secret war. Well, okay. So you went from fighting a conventional force mm-hmm. to fighting elements of extremism that yet to be identified conclusively that kind of gravitated into an insurgency. So you capture all these people, they're either criminals or they're terrorists or associated with terrorists or whatever have you, and you got to put them somewhere. And also, you know, when Saddam Hussein was still in power and we're on the eve of our invasion, started releasing all these prisoners, mm-hmm. about 20,000 of them. Well, you got to put them somewhere. You got to put them in 6 prisons in Baghdad, or large detention camps. One of them, the largest, of course, is Abu Ghraib. The others was Camp mm-hmm. Buka, Camp Cropper for the political prisoners in Ashraf. So that facility, being the largest of it, held, between 8,000 to 9,000 prisoners at the time, or detainees at the time we were there. And I asked the question of my peers when I was doing the investigation of why do we have it at Abu Ghraib? Why don't we put it outside somewhere in the open desert where it's not next to another unit, I'm sorry, to another city? Because that prison was actually in a town of Abu Ghraib where it was being shelled incessantly, mortared incessantly, sniped at incessantly by the enemy. And, you know, not only are we detaining, but we're also fighting and interrogating and collecting intelligence and whatever have you. So they're in high jeopardy in that site. And, of course, it was not exactly the prime location to have a detention site, but it was there. The reality is you have a compound, mm-hmm. a hard site, you might say, with all the walls, even though it was damaged, to hold those prisoners, whether they're detainees or whether they're criminals being held by the Iraqi Iraqi police.
Mm-hmm. So, but what is there? Is there one element that stands out in your mind in retrospect with regard to the mission that led to this failure? In other words, as I understand it, military intelligence was using military police to essentially prepare some of these detainees for what intelligence might do to them to get information about the nature of our adversary?
Well, detainee operations in Iraq were fragmented to begin with. There was no unity of effort, you might say. There was no single element that says, I'm in command of all detainee operations in theater. It was given to a commander of MP forces, and she was made responsible for all of that, for detention operations, which to some people think is separate and distinct from interrogation operations, but they're actually within the same segment of conducting that type of thing. So either one of them have to be in charge. Well, at the time, the military police was either undermanned or did not understand their mission, and then the pressure given to the intelligence collection community was that, get me the actionable intelligence and do whatever resources that you have. So there was a tension, a conflict, you might say, but clearly you had two sets of missions, but there was no concentric element in there to put them all in one unified effort. So, and that causes ambiguity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whatever successes was being held at Guantanamo was applied over there, or at least in terms of what the people said to me during my interviews of them. Mm-hmm. But that ambiguity existed. And ambiguity leads to chaos. Mm-hmm. If one does not understand what the other is doing, then it just happens to be on the same side, and then you infuse other elements, contractors and OGA elements in there, you know, and you ask the question, who's in charge? Nobody wants to raise their hand. But clearly the commander of the forces in Iraq is in charge.
So do you feel, after all of this, that there was an effort to cover up the kinds of things that you discovered? I mean, were the people who committed these horrible acts, was in their mind, were they following orders, and were there such orders?
I did not find anything written otherwise, and I'd hate to speculate on that. But I can only assume that there was source. From my standpoint, I don't believe that there was a cover-up. What I believe was that it was held in such secrecy, mm-hmm. a lot of the conduct that was being done, and people were not policing themselves. There was no oversight of those kind of activities. It was left to the vices of lower soldiers and other elements in there that they were not checking themselves for procedures, proper procedures and the like, because they're stressed. They're told, get me this stuff and get it to me soon. Well, if you're undermanned and you're not resourced properly and there's a war going on, you're going to try and get that. But I'm driven by a piece of regulation. It was tri-service regulation that said that the stresses of combat is not an excuse for abusive or illegal actions at war. And I was driven by that particular comment. So we pride our military, for example, to follow their conscience in making sure that what we do in the conduct of war is proper. Because if we do otherwise, it's not just them that's going to answer for it. It's our nation that's going to answer for it. But unfortunately, there were some leaders who somehow forgot that.
In the military or in the political side?
I think both sides. Because there's got to be a congruency between what policy says and what the military has to apply. If you recall, the policy on torture was vehemently opposed by the military's legal counsels. If you recall that.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Alberto Mora, for example, the general counsel of the Navy, said, this is incredible. General Hudson, general counsel of the Navy, said, this is atrocious. We have one of this and one of that, and then you're asking us to apply that, you know, where the protection of our U.S. forces now is under jeopardy, but it protects the civilian elements. I find that rather incredulous, to say the least.
As you look back at this, your career is built on the organization of the military, making the military work, problems of logistics, and so on. What is the failure here? Is it a failure to clearly to define the mission? Is it arrogance? Is it a lack of resources? A lack of training? I mean, is there one thing that stands out in your mind in retrospect?
No. War is such a destructive nature, but you could also regulate and manage it. If you have a clear set of mission and a clear set of task, and sometimes those change over time, and it's all dependent on the conditions that you're entering into, the environment, you might say. So we have to be flexible. But one of the principles of a couple of the principles of war is that, one, keep it simple, and two, you must have a unity of effort. And it's tremendously complex to fight a war that involves not just our U.S. forces, but coalition forces. You know, all these moving parts, we call it. It's easy to try and judge that, you know, as you're watching it on TV, but it's harder to manage and command and control that out in the field. But we have such competent people that our generals today, you know, lieutenant colonels today, that are doing that. But as you may want, it's kind of interesting that sometimes from the civilian side, it's hard that you have a policy that governs that execution. After all, you know, the military is subservient to civil authorities. Mm-hmm. So, and that there's a gap that existed, I believe.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned private contractors. Were they a big part of this? I mean, because when you're talking private contractors, mm-hmm. you're really talking, we're finding out, people outside of the laws and the chains of command that you're talking about.
Exactly. We have thousands of contractors on the battlefield today. And that's a necessity because we just don't have the kind of resources to prosecute a war. So you go through the outsourcing side because a lot of these folks have that capacity, like moving supplies, providing meals and the like, transportation for that matter. Now we have security contractors. But I think the failings there is that they have to follow the same standards that we are doing as a military.
But they're not. In many cases.
Well, yes, they're not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of our failings that has to be addressed. I mean, you know, if they commit a crime, they should be held accountable. We do have the Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, for example, and somehow the language doesn't merit in prosecuting these security contractors. So what do? We send them home, and then we fire them. And then, of course, you got dead people all over the place, or assaulted for that place, you know. And I find it incredible that our justice system cannot find in itself to prosecute. You know, we readily prosecute our military troops, but somehow we find it difficult to prosecute our contractors.
Mm-hmm. You, when one reads about your career and your service throughout your career and then this particular assignment, I must say you strike me as a professional's professional, and you were the right person at the right time to do this job. What then happened to you, you were caught up in the political vortex of Washington and the leaking of the report and the appearance before Congress and the meetings with Mr. Rumsfeld. What comments can you— what are your reflections on that experience? Because here you were, a soldier doing a soldier's job according to the highest tradition, and then you seem to have been caught up in a political football for partly by an administration that didn't want to, if it knew the truth, it didn't want it known generally.
Funny you should mention that. Well, my advice, and it was no surprise to me, because it was a lose-lose proposition. What I told my investigation team was, if this report could not withstand scrutiny, then we have to do it again and find where the eaches that we have to fill in to ensure that there's integrity in our report. So we hold our ground. We believe in our values. We believe in our oath. We believe that we have to defend our nation. We believe in our soldiering, in our protecting our buddies, and that we have to tell the truth above all. But you know, there's always a consequence to demonstrating integrity. There's a consequence to that, and we were willing to take that consequence, provided, of course, that you know, we believe in ourselves and we believe that our nation will be safer, and that our comrades in arms would be protected. Otherwise, if we compromise that, we're no better than the enemy that we're fighting. And then we violate our own principles. So none of my teammates have been, you might say, scrutinized. They've been in the military, and I wanted them to be protected so they can continue advancing in the military. One, in fact, is running for political office in Dayton, Ohio, and I hold them in high esteem. But, you know, if you're facing the nation and members of Congress and not tell the truth, I think it would be totally dishonest to our nation that we took an oath to when we were first commissioned as soldiers and as first commissioned, I'm sorry, as enlisted as soldiers and as commissioned of officers. We have a set of values that we have to uphold, and we have an institution that we need to protect. The institution, our military institution, is older than our nation, as you know, and we need to preserve that, in as much as preserving the security of our nation. Because it's not as much as the leaders that we are obeying or are subservient to. It's the country that we're subservient to.
The result of this inquiry was, on your career, from the press, one thinks that is led to believe that essentially you were pushed to the side by the administration and ultimately took an early retirement. Is that, do you want to talk about that? Because I think it's important because we, you know, as a country, you've just talked about your responsibility to the country, but it would seem the country has a responsibility to soldiers like you to honor their integrity.
Well, the country doesn't owe me anything. I owe the country a lot. I came here as an immigrant. I had the privilege of serving my country. I have the exceptional and honored privilege of leading soldiers and caring for their families. I mean, it's indescribable to have that feeling. But I don't question openly why I was asked to retire. And I was told by sources in higher places that I have now become the enemy more than several times, that they want to get rid of me because, you know, I was incompetent. I should have said what I said. I should have agreed with the party line. I just don't subscribe to that. I have a greater responsibility and obligation to a country that was fortunate enough or was generous enough to put me in a place where I could serve them. To think otherwise would be, you know, a compromise of my own set of principles.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, if we go back to the story of your father, in a way, he never got the recognition that he deserved because of his heroism in World War II, and you were able to do something about that.
That was a great thing. He retired in 1962, and I remember him going to work that day. And I knew he was going to retire. And so he goes to work. He comes home with his packing certificate. The next day he goes back to work because the unit he was with in Hawaii was being deployed to Vietnam. And he remained dedicated to that. So over time, I was somewhat mesmerized that when I see his picture on the wall there in our living room in his earlier days, he has a lot of service medal, you know, one of those, I've been to Asia, I've been to this, but no medal for achievement or for wartime service and the like. So I researched it and found out that there was a lot more to what he did. I read his record, and I was intrigued by it all. He had an impeccable record of service for a country, but nobody recognized him. So I collected all the documents and whatever have you, and requested for his medal set. And so on his 80th birthday, the commanding general of the 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii, I presented him with his Medal of Honor. I'm sorry, Bronze Star Medal. Excuse me, his Bronze Star Medal, and his POW Medal. And pinned it on his coat. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, that was 54 years after the end of World War II, and at the same time, he was given his certificate of retirement and my mother the certificate of appreciation for her unfailing and undivided loyalty in serving her husband throughout his 20 years of service. That was 37 years after he retired on his 80th birthday in 1999. And then that summer, I took both of them back to Bataan, and where he wanted to see where the kilometer marker where he was captured, but we were not able to see that because he was covered. So I think it's our responsibility for our veterans, namely my dad, that there's no statute of limitation to give honor to those who are willing to serve their country and give their life. So we can live free today. Mm-hmm. And he's 89 today. He is a recalcitrant old man, sort of like the replication of the Jack Lemmon Walter Matthau movie. He's just that. But, and I have great respect for them. I have great respect for my mother. And they bring us inspiration. And I am where I am today, and I am how successful I am today. And I'm thankful to them.
Well, one final question requiring a brief answer. If students were to watch this video, what lessons should they draw from your life story, your service, and your heroism in this matter of Abu Ghraib that we would like not to wait for your son or your grandson to get you the medal that you deserve for what you did in this last part of your career?
First of all, thank you for those generous words, but I don't consider myself a hero. I'm just one of those that were directed to do something, and there was expectations out of that. I'm reminded of a time when I spoke to fifth and sixth graders out of Maine, an elementary school in Maine, and they wanted me, the teachers, Larry Ross, wanted me to convey something to them. And the same thing when I convey to the students, not just at UC Berkeley, but the students who are the captains of our future here today, that at the end of the day, what matters most of whatever what you do in whatever place, location, at the end of the day, what matters most is integrity and dignity. You have to live with yourself. And you have to look at other people and, you know, be as dignified and be as truthful as you can. Because our country was born out of that, our values was born out of that, and our people expects that of us.
General, on that note, I want to thank you very much for coming to our program, for being on the Berkeley campus as the guest of our Human Rights Center, and thank you for all you did for the country.
You're very welcome, and I'm very delighted to be here.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.